This week on The Right Side, the Alberta Party discusses a potential PST. The BC's strong, stable minority is in doubt over LNG, hypocrisy over the abortion clause in the federal government's summer jobs program, and a critical look at the allegations leading to three politicians resigning. This is The Right Side, episode 53, recorded Saturday, January 27th, 2018. Defining allegations. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of The Right Side. Patrick and myself are back this week, as we are each and every week. Welcome back.
We're back this week and in the last week of January, and it's not been a quiet month for news, has it? Especially
Definitely with all the things
that have been going on this past week, eh?
Yeah, especially in the last 48 to 72 hours, but we'll get to that just a bit later and the coverage that's been surrounding that. But nonetheless, if you're joining us for the first time, The Right Side is a podcast where we cut through bias and sensationalism in the mainstream media and talk about the angles of the story that should be talked about but are often just glossed over entirely when I think good portions of the population could deserve to hear that other side of the story, especially with some of the stuff we're going to be talking about this week. So, you ready to begin?
I'm all set. What do you have for us to start with?
Well, we're going to start off in Alberta this week, and that's actually a good place to start because the Alberta Party had their first leadership debate on January 24th, this past Wednesday in Edmonton. Now, recall that the Alberta Party leadership was vacated when Greg Clark stepped down to raise the profile of the party and bring new members and new energy into the party ahead of the 2019 election. So this was a very large event for the Alberta Party. There were roughly 330 people in attendance, which is something the Alberta Party hasn't seen before. So they were very pleased with that. Now, this debate touched on all sides of the issues that Alberta is currently facing, whether it be energy, the environment, and even the budgetary problems that the province faces and how we're going to pay that down. And that was actually something that was talked about the most in this debate. And, you know, there were some definite questions raised at this debate of ways that the Alberta Party would go forward if they were elected in terms of getting Alberta's fiscal house in order, let's say. You know, as we talked about a number of weeks ago, the Alberta Party's main goal is to do politics differently in Alberta and put the province ahead of any one ideology. So that's why we're seeing these various perspectives on what should be done to, in effect, bring the budget into balance and control spending to a degree here in Alberta. So, you know, the budget deficit is something that hasn't always existed in Alberta, but it's something that's become quite structural and something that needs to be fixed and has really been exacerbated since the 2015 election here with the NDP. So Kara Levi's in this debate was afraid to touch no topics. And one of those topics that she wasn't afraid to touch was a provincial sales tax, or a PSD. She said that, "I would really like to see us to start consider a value-added point of sales tax. That's a source of revenue that we really haven't been able to talk about, and none of our opponents have had the courage to talk about that in the past." And her rationale is that the province needs a stable base of revenue, particularly for day-to-day program spending, and that's the way that she sees it. But recall previously that the UCP has put out some draft policy calling for spending reductions that would bring us, in effect, down to the same level as British Columbia, which is roughly 20% less spent in BC per capita than here in Alberta. And when you consider that the populations are somewhat similar in size, and yet we somehow manage to spend 20% more than BC, that's evidence of a spending problem and not necessarily a revenue problem, as she wants to do. Both Stephen Mandel and Rick Fraser in the debate did not like the idea of a PST. Mandel stated that if he ever was going to bring in a PST, he would hold a referendum. And I think that kind of goes back to what happened to BC Premier Gordon Campbell when he brought in the HST there, and he ended up having a referendum to remove that.
Yeah, exactly. And there was lots of calls for a referendum beforehand, and then they just went ahead with the tax anyways. And then there was enough signatures granted that they had to do a referendum, and then the HST was then soundly defeated and repealed, and then Gordon Campbell had to resign in disgrace, basically, and it kind of capped off the end of his almost like 12-year legacy as BC Liberal leader. So it when it comes to adding taxes onto the populace, you have to have a lot of political capital and a lot of goodwill to be able to do so.
Yeah, definitely. And, Mandel also said that he believes the tax burden placed on the residents of Alberta should not increase. And one of his top priorities with this would be balancing the budget. And he would do that through looking at what's being spent where and where he can find efficiencies in the government. And now, with this talk of the PST, the media has also been keen to point out that economists both in Edmonton and Calgary have been telling the finance minister, Joe Cece, that a sales tax would be a good source of revenue. It would be a good solid source of revenue that would definitely help to balance the books. But both Joe Cece and Rachel Notley say that there will be no sales tax in Alberta's future under their watch. Now, at this point, we also need to remember that in the 2015 race, a carbon tax was also not promised by any of the major parties, but here we are with a carbon tax. So I think it's fair to say that, if the NDP was reelected in 2019 or if the Alberta Party wins, they will definitely be looking at the potential of adding a provincial sales tax to help bring more money in for government spending. Which, when you think about it, that's the same kind of lying by omission story that we've had with the carbon tax before. And we had this discussion at the end of 2017 that if you're lying by omitting a key fact, you are still lying, even if that is, just glossed over in your platform. So the very fact that this PST is being talked about in the Alberta Party leadership debate should be raising questions for everyone who is looking to get involved with the Alberta Party, and they should be asking themselves, and they should be asking both Stephen Mandel and Rick Fraser some very pointed questions about what they actually think of a PST and what guarantees they can make that they won't bring one of those in if they become leader. Because let's face it, you go out to buy something big, a large ticket item, people are not going to want to spend an additional 5 to 7% in sales tax. I don't think anyone in Alberta would want to do that in their right mind. I know I certainly wouldn't. I know you wouldn't. And I think the vast majority of the populace wouldn't.
That's right. If you're buying something that's worth $1,000, a 7% sales tax that we have in BC on that is an additional $70 that you have to pay on top of the $50 that you already have to pay for the federal GST, and that's a quite a big portion of money, especially as costs go up, because that's not just going to raise costs on people buying a lot. It's going to raise the cost on poorer people that probably wouldn't be able
Definitely.
to afford the rising costs. It's not something that hits people on a bell curve. It hits everyone at the exact same rate. And that's actually one of the biggest concerns with sales taxes, is that it hits poorer people just as much as it does the richer people.
Yeah, definitely. And on that same note, there's also discussion at these debates about the carbon tax, and they agree in principle that a carbon tax is a good idea, but specifically Stephen Mandel also doesn't like the idea that there are carbon tax rebates going out to a portion of the population, and that's unfair for everyone else. So there's lots of questions being talked about, and we're starting to see various different fiscal ideologies emerge in this race. I think it's safe to say that Kara Levi would ultimately have a fiscal policy that is probably in line with the Alberta Liberal Party, whereas with both Rick Fraser and Stephen Mandel, we're seeing echoes of what the old Progressive Conservatives would do, which is kind of what we foreshadowed when both of these two got back into the race. as they are both, of course, former Progressive Conservative members. So this is definitely something that people need to watch out for when they're thinking about the Alberta Party, and the people who are Alberta Party members definitely need to have this in their mind when they go and vote for their leader at the end of February, because, I mean, let's face it, no one wants to pay a provincial sales tax, so that's definitely something that needs to be asked of all three of them, even more since the topic has now been touched on at this first leadership debate. We'll definitely be watching to see what happens in the subsequent debates on this, and if there are any developments, we'll bring it to the right side. All right. BC.
Excellent.
It looks
well,
let's
like move on to BC. And,
it's like the strong, stable minority is potentially fracturing, maybe just a bit.
Exactly, and that's actually one of the most memorable quotes to come out of the May 2017 election, was the BC Green Party leader calling his supply and confidence agreement with the governing NDP the beginning of a, quote, strong, stable minority government, and we talked about that during that time period as well, quite a bit. And political scientists and myself and Shane as well included, we all chuckled a bit at that news because we all know that minority governments are rarely stable, and it actually appears that there are cracks appearing in the strong, stable minority government, as the Green Party leader actually threatened to bring down the government if the NDP attempted to pursue LNG projects, LNG being liquefied natural gas. He said, quote, if BC starts to focus again on trying to land an LNG industry, given all that has happened, I can tell you I am voting government down, the Green leader vowed in a December 31st interview. He repeated this line in the sand this week on Twitter. He said, quote, if the BC NDP caucus continues their generational sellout embodied in the LNG folly of the BC Liberals, their government will fall. Now, as Les Lyon of the Times Colonist writes, Weaver seems to be assuming that Liberals would vote against LNG, which is a big logic leap. Any vote on LNG could easily go 83-3. He's also assuming it would be a confidence vote, which isn't necessarily so. Now, the February 13th throne speech would provide the first opportunity to vote against the NDP, but under the rules of the House, the New Democrats could forestall that vote for weeks, and still, the Greens and the opposition Liberals could cause a vote of non-confidence in this coming session, which could trigger a provincial election just a year after the last one. However, the Liberals elect a new leader on February 3rd, next Saturday, which I'll probably be talking about next week, and an early spring election will force the party to campaign with an unproven leader. Now, the premier confirmed that during the trade mission to Asia this past week, he had every intention of exploring support for the LNG Canada to export terminal that Shell and its Asian partners are proposing for Kitimat, which is located in northern coastal BC. He said, quote, I'll be meeting with partners of LNG Canada just to let them know we're okay with LNG development, provided there are benefits to British Columbians through jobs, there is a fair return for the resource, our climate action objectives can be realized, and that First Nations are partners. You've heard this from me before, and you'll hear it from me again. And that's actually something that we've actually known about for quite a while. The NDP's four conditions for LNG approval date back almost 2 years and were clearly stated in the party election platform. Weaver can scarcely claim that they come as a surprise. However, although the NDP campaigned in the past election on a promise to pursue LNG investment so long as it meets the party's conditions, Weaver said he was blindsided by the premier's plans to court investors. Now, government officials say that their LNG position was discussed with Weaver during those negotiations between the two parties that led to the confidence and supply agreement. And the party no doubt feels blindsided by Weaver's threat, although Weaver feels the same way about the NDP for their push for the LNG. And even though he said that this summer that switching to proportional representation was his top priority, he now says fighting climate change trumps that and is the real reason he got into politics in the first place. He said, quote, there is no way I will stand by and allow future generations to be thrown by a bunch of politicians who gave them hope but now throw them under a bus. Now, Weaver said that the governing agreement includes a commitment to climate change, climate action plan, and based on his 30 years of work as a climate scientist, he is convinced that BC cannot launch an LNG industry and meet its targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. He says, quote, "You can't have LNG and meet the targets. That is the sword I would die on." Now, the governing agreement stipulates that the BC Green MLAs will support the NDP during confidence votes as long as there are, quote, "no surprises." Well, Weaver now thinks that supporting LNG ranks as a surprise, even though it clearly is not at all. Now, the mayors of Dawson Creek and Fort St. John in BC's northeast, where gas for the export facility would come from, they joined forces with Kitimat Mayor Phil Gurmuth and Haisla Nation Councillor Kevin Stewart to demand the province strongly support LNG development. This is something that a lot of people in the BC interior are really looking forward to. And Bill Tielemann, who is the co-chair of the No BC Proportional Representation Society, who I talked about 2 weeks ago on episode 51, he minced no words in an email to Global News' Keith Baldry. He said, quote, "Not only are Andrew Weaver and the BC Green Party creating political instability, they're also creating economic instability, where businesses and investors have no idea from one day to the next what might become an issue for the BC Greens to bring down the government." As Weaver also wants a ban on foreign house buyers, going on another Twitter tirade on the subject, Horgan actually won't go that far. He won't ban foreign house buyers from buying property in BC. So will this eventually come to, quote, "ban foreign buyers or I'll bring the government down as well"? It's hard to say. Now, the standoff counters the impression that the Greens and NDP have morphed into one big entity, which is what the Liberals say is a big reason to not support proportional representation. But Weaver's threat erodes all his previous assurances that minority governments can be just as stable as majorities, and that in turn blows a big hole in the campaign to change to a proportional representation voting model, which is, of course, a reform that the Greens really, really want, as I've talked about before. Now, proportional representation, it almost guarantees that continuing minority governments in BC, so Weaver will be campaigning for such a move at the same time that he's proving how much more precarious and uncertain it is than this current system. And voters have to put up with the confidence crisis every time the NDP does something that Weaver disagrees with. A lot of people will realize that proportional representation does not offer a strong, stable minority government after all.
And I think the key point about this is, you know, you can see what Andrew Weaver's true values are. And, you know, he claimed to want a strong, stable minority government, but, you know, it hasn't even been a year yet. And here we are talking about bringing down the government on the issue of climate change, which, as you said, people thought proportional representation was his key issue. And there's also the huge misplay that he thinks he could bring down the government on an LNG proposal when you said it's quite clear that the Liberals who are in the House will most definitely support LNG. And you know, with no Liberal leader in place and an untested Liberal leader, they're unlikely to want to go to the polls this soon. So I think the only one who comes away from this potentially losing is Andrew Weaver.
Exactly. I mean, he's only got 3 seats in the 87-seat legislature, and if he doesn't get proportional representation through, that also causes a blow to them, as they would stand a lot to gain if that went through. And if he is jeopardizing this by going after LNG, it makes you wonder what he actually stands for.
Yeah, right? Definitely. And I mean, if you think about this, LNG projects have been around in BC for a long time. It's a much cleaner form of energy than some of the other forms of energy out there, like coal. So you would think that there would be a room for compromise here, which of course is also in the spirit of minority governments and cooperation across parties, which I guess we're not seeing right now. So.
No, and we're not. And there's no actual word if the BC Liberals would support the NDP on either a LNG platform here, but that's something that they campaigned strongly for beforehand. So I really don't see the Liberals voting against this, especially when they don't have a leader. Because that would just be folly for them. They don't want to go to an election this soon after they're going through a bit of turmoil themselves. They want to elect a leader and then have them have a bit of time before they go to an election. So I don't see it happening personally, but who knows?
Who knows?
I've been surprised before.
Right. Anything can happen. And I think Alberta is a great example of that. And I mean, you guys might just decide to be taking after Alberta, but we'll just have to wait and see.
Exactly.
All right. Moving on to Canada this week. You don't normally hear too much from backbench MPs in a majority government. And what we're hearing now is from Liberal MP Scott Sims from Newfoundland. And the headline we're talking about this week is that Scott Sims says that the abortion clause in the summer jobs program is, quote, not right. So, you know, it's been no secret that Justin Trudeau is pro-choice, and pro-choice refers to the opinion that when it comes to an abortion, that this abortion should be freely available upon request to the person if they want it. And during the 2015 campaign, Trudeau made headlines when he necessitated that all of his candidates and MPs under the Liberal Party must be pro-choice, but that doesn't really go over well with some of these MPs, because there are what have been called before blue liberals, you know, liberals who are in the Liberal Party but lean conservative in some areas, and in this case on the abortion issue. And these people were allowed to run because they were incumbents, but there's going to be some question about, you know, if an issue like this came up in the future, what would their place in the party be? And we're actually seeing that right now. So what brought this about is that the government recently introduced their summer jobs program and included with this, to receive funding, a group who wants to access this grant must support abortion rights. And the exact wording is that employers must declare that both the job and the organization's core mandate respect individual human rights in Canada. And these include reproductive rights. And this has Scott Sims, the Liberal MP from Newfoundland, pushing for a reverse of this clause. Scott Sims said that the application is asking them to do something that they shouldn't be asked to do for the sake of a summer job for kids. And that is the key point here, is that most of these summer jobs programs are not geared towards adults. They're geared towards kids in high school. And the reason this becomes an issue is that most of these summer jobs come from churches or Christian groups, which I think we can all understand why they would have an issue with this clause. It goes contrary to their beliefs. Ultimately, Scott Sims is showing a good deal of goodwill because he is willing to compromise on this and have the clause rewritten to only limit funding for jobs or programs that are involved in campaigning to change Canadian law. So basically, if a job was working to, I don't know, lobby a government or maybe be part of the government somewhere, then they would need to support this. But he wants just any job that's not associated with government to not have this clause attached to it. Now, you might think that this is the end of the issue, but ultimately what it comes down to is that, you know, this is being missed by the media, because the 2015 race was one where Justin Trudeau was running on a platform of multiculturalism and tolerance for different viewpoints. And what do we have here? This is, in fact, a case of intolerance for different viewpoints when you think about it. If you're not going to give a group access to your grant program because they think differently than you, I can't think of anything that is more intolerant than that, even when these groups are doing good things for these adolescents who are growing up. It just makes zero sense that there is no story about this side of the fact that this issue of intolerance is just being missed. It's almost unbelievable. Now, you know, Justin Trudeau was super selective with his MPs in the 2015 race, so we'll have to wait and see about where this goes going forward and if this is relented on. But based on the fact that this already seems to be moving out of the media's viewpoint, I don't think we're going to see much movement on this. Now, also looking at this from a different angle, recall last summer we had our episode entitled The Scheer Smear, where as soon as Andrew Scheer was elected leader of the Conservative Party, the media set out to unearth his past and paint him as the conservative scary man. And one of the points they talked about was abortion and how Scheer, just like Prime Minister Stephen Harper, would supposedly have a hidden agenda to limit abortion rights. And what they are right now in Canada is purely that abortion is not illegal, but there is no set definition on when it can be carried out or how it can be carried out or if it needs to be carried out by federal or provincial jurisdictions. And this was covered at length this past summer, even though it wasn't true from Andrew Scheer's side. But here we have the Liberals who campaigned on tolerance and multiculturalism, but they're extensively limiting what groups may receive government funding. And this is a pure example of hypocrisy that just isn't being talked about. And, you know, I guess we could be thankful here that this issue is being talked about even at all in the mainstream media, and it's just not glossed over. And one might even say that there's a hidden agenda by this government and maybe the media against those of the Christian religious faith. And nonetheless, for a party that preaches tolerance of ideas, this isn't the way that they should be campaigning and creating policy.
That's right, and that's something that the media has not really picked up too much on. There's, of course, a bigger story that I'll be talking about in just a few moments that they've picked up on instead, and this has kind of been swept under the rug. But what really has come about of this is that they haven't really been talking very much about the hypocrisy of the government wanting to go to be on the side of tolerance and acceptance of all beliefs. And then they're going ahead with this, which isn't respecting that other people have different opinions than them and that they might have different ways of coming to a conclusion on an issue.
Yeah.
And that these people might still be doing good. And a lot of these programs are really helpful to a lot of people, especially a lot of young Canadians who have to rely on them to get a step into the employment sector. And for the government to be cutting funding on them basically just based on their own beliefs, in itself isn't respecting humanitarian rights that's set out in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And for them to do that and then claim that they're on the moral high ground and then have the media not really talk about it very much, that's something that should be looked into a lot more, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, just one more thing on this, you know, the way that the government is going against these groups, you think these governments were actually outright performing abortions illegally or something to that degree, but there's nothing of that happening. It's just a case that that is what these organizations believe, and they're not even referring people or trying to stop people from getting these abortions. It's just a core belief that the government doesn't like, which is really disappointing for some government that campaigned on tolerance of ideas. So
mm-hmm.
I'll just have to wait and see, but I don't think we're going to get anywhere on this case, unfortunately. All right. Firing line time, the big story of the week and the year,
so,
probably.
Of course, the firing line, we reserve the firing line segment to be about a story that's either not covered very well, or it has not been covered fairly, or it's just been completely missed by the media. And I think it's fair to say that this story has not been missed by the media. It's been something that's been covered far and wide by national news, by international news, and, you know, your local news stations as well. And you'd really have to be living under a rock to not hear about it. And it would be remiss of us to not weigh on it as well and give you a full blow-by-blow of the media's coverage. For those who haven't heard, this past week the nation was stunned as three powerful male politicians resigned in disgrace after allegations of sexual harassment were reported in the media and calls were made for them to resign. Now, whether or not these allegations are true or not will be up for the police and the courts to decide. but the media has gaily reported on all of them to the Canadian public without verifying whether they're true or not. Now, to keep things together and simple, I'm going to go through them one by one. The first one we'll mention is now former federal Liberal cabinet minister Kent Hare. Now, it seems like we've talked about Kent Hare quite a bit in the past 2 months, but appears we need to mention him just once more. Now, I first covered Kent Hare's appalling behavior on episode 46, where Hare openly mocked a group of thalidomide survivors and dismissed people with disabilities, saying that they, quote, don't have it so bad, and, quote, if their lifespans are shortened, that's good for the Canadian government. Now, there was a lot of press about that, and nothing really came of it, as Trudeau still kept him in cabinet and still kept him in the Liberal caucus, but nothing really happened. Now, many other people over the past 2 months since that story have come forward about Hare's behavior, and recently there have been sexual harassment complaints leveled against him by accusers who have gone to the media to report their stories. Now, Hare has since resigned from cabinet. Late Wednesday night, Alberta public servant Kristen Raworth tweeted that she was told to avoid being in an elevator with Kent Hare on her first day working at the legislature. She alleged that Hare made verbally sexually suggestive comments to a number of women and once told her, quote, you're yummy. Now, others have come forward either on social media or in the media talking about Hare's inappropriate behavior with women. On Twitter, another woman said that there have been warnings circulating in Ottawa for more than a year. Stay away from Hare at receptions. Don't let his hands get close to you and don't get close to him when he drinks. Another woman said there is a lot of ableism involved with Kent Hare because no one wants to be mean to the guy in the wheelchair. Now, Raworth challenged Trudeau. She said that Kent Hare was a cabinet minister, quote, in the government of a man who claims to believe in gender equality. So let's test that, Justin Trudeau. Get rid of him. Now, he's since resigned from cabinet, and Trudeau made a statement shortly after. Quote, harassment of any kind is unacceptable, and Canadians have a right to live and work in environments free from harassment. As a government, we take any allegations of misconduct extremely seriously. Today, I accepted the Honorable Kent Hare's resignation from cabinet pending the outcome of the investigation. Now, Kent Hare, as I said before, is still in the Liberal caucus. Federal Calgary Liberal MP Darshan Kang resigned from the Liberal caucus just last year after similar allegations were raised against him. Now, the Prime Minister made clear that Hare is on a leave of absence, pending the outcome of an investigation. The law firm Reuben Tomlinson is already investigating allegations of inappropriate behavior by a senior PMO official, Claude-Éric Gagné, who is on leave from his position as Deputy Director of Operations. So there's been a few cases there in the Federal Liberal Party where there's been a lot of sexual harassment allegations being thrown back and forth. But let's move on to Jamie Bailey, who is now the former leader of the Nova Scotia Progressive Conservative Party. Tara Miller, who is the president of the party, says that she was told by multiple sources about a single incident involving inappropriate behavior by Bailey and an unnamed victim, and the party moved swiftly to force him to resign. Miller later disclosed that an investigator hired by the party to look into an allegation of harassment last month found him to be in breach of legislature harassment policy. At the time, Halifax police said they had not received a report related to the situation. Now, caucus spokeswoman Jenny Edge later clarified that the initial information that Miller received did not directly come from the individual at the center of the complaint. She said it was the result of that person telling other people who then went to the party president. Now, news of the allegations has left many members of the party reeling. Bailey, who had previously announced his intentions in November to leave office when a new leader is chosen later this year, has a record of defending women's rights in Parliament and otherwise. Now, the PCs are scheduled to hold their annual general meeting and convention in 2 weeks in Halifax. While a leader will not be chosen at that meeting, registration numbers are up, and it's clear that that is something that they're going to be talking about. Now, Miller said that an inexperienced third-party Halifax-based lawyer conducted an investigation and that Bailey and the individual participated fully and were represented by legal counsel. She said that the lawyer used definitions from the legislature's policy to make findings which concluded that Bailey was in breach. She said, quote, those findings were delivered on Tuesday, January 23rd. The PC Party of Nova Scotia requested and accepted the immediate resignation of Mr. Bailey on Wednesday, January 24th. She said the findings are a privileged report that will not be made publicly available in order to protect the identity of the individual. So it appears that for now, at least, that matter is a closed case, and we won't be hearing any more about Mr. Bailey or anything that had happened. It's going to remain completely confidential, and nothing more is going to be made about that.
That doesn't seem right for someone who could potentially be premier in waiting.
Yeah, I mean, he was they just fought an election in the summer, I believe it was, and the PCs made a lot of gains under Bailey's leadership, and Stephen McNeil's Nova Scotia Liberals are actually just ahead on a majority by 3 seats. So it's a very interesting time in Nova Scotia politics, and how this will affect the next election, we'll just have to keep following, of course. But it seems like the PCs are all kind of on board with this, and that they all are okay with them forcing Bailey out, because he apparently was going to resign anyways, but now just because of this one individual report, they found that it's true, so they made him resign.
And that's not the end of it this week, unfortunately.
No, finally, we have the now former leader of the Ontario Progressive Conservative Party, Patrick Brown. Now, after allegations of sexual harassment were levied against him in the media, he held a late-night press conference on Tuesday night, the very same Tuesday that that the allegations about Jamie Bailey came about. And Patrick Brown tearfully denied the allegations and defended his character. Hours later, his senior staff had resigned on him, and he was forced to resign from party leadership only months before an election was going to be held in June. Now, Brown resigned as leader after a conference call with his fellow party members after CTV News first quote, reported the exclusive and serious allegations from two women. Now, the first incident happened when Brown was in his late 20s and he was working in Ottawa. Now, the woman, who was an 18-year-old high school student in Barrie at the time, said that she and a mutual friend had met Brown at a bar. Keep in mind that the drinking age in Ontario is 19, so she was already breaking the law just by being there. Now, Brown then invited them back to his home and provided them with alcohol. Patrick Brown, of course, is quite well known for being a teetotaler, which means that he doesn't drink alcohol whatsoever. And now, this first woman said that she was drunk when Brown invited her for the tour of the home, and then the pair entered the bedroom, and then he made advances towards her, which I won't talk about, but you can read in the show notes, of course. And basically, she went along with it before stopping, and then she said, quote, it was like a controlling thing, like I just remember I wanted to go, but that wasn't happening. She says she then left his house and went to a nearby friend's place. And she said on, you know, under condition of anonymity, she lashed out at him and said, quote, he is an old single politician preying on young girls. He's just a sad person. And that person is now 29 years old, who is the exact same age that Brown was when he did this supposed act at the time. Now, another woman came forward with another story detailing her time working for the MP in then Prime Minister Stephen Harper's government back in Ottawa, and she spoke to CTV News as well in an on-camera interview. She said that she met the then Conservative MP in November 2012 on an Air Canada flight when she was 18, coming home from university. Hours after the flight, Brown ended up sending the woman a message on Facebook. Are you impressed that I remembered your name? I am LOL. So then Brown gave the woman his phone number and the names of Barry bars that he'd been at that night, offering to help her skip any lineups, even though she was just 18 at the time. you know, once again below Ontario's legal drinking age. So she says that, quote, "I kind of laughed it off as an older man hitting on me," the former staffer said. She didn't take him up on the offer, but months later, when she was looking for a summer jobs program, she reached out to Brown and asked if he had any openings or if he knew of any other opportunities. So after an interview, he actually hired her to work on in his Barrie constituency office. So then they worked together back and forth, and they ended up going to an after party at a nightclub. And then after the bar closed, the party ended up going back to Brown's home, kind of like the other situation. And it was all ended up being on social media. There's pictures that you could now find in the CTV article. All that delegated that this actually happened, or that the party happened. Now, the woman says that she was extremely drunk when Brown invited her and into his bedroom to look at photographs from a trip to Asia. And then she says, "The next thing I know is he's kissing me, sitting beside me, kissing me, and then I was kind of just froze up. And he laid me down onto the bed and then got on top of me, and I remember consciously trying not to move my mouth, and I was just not moving. So I was laying there immobile, and he kept going." And she says that she told him to stop, and then he did, and that she asked him to take her home, and he then did that as well. So basically, when she told her that she was uncomfortable and that she wanted him to stop, he did, and then he took her home again. And that was it. That they didn't have any further interaction after that. So those were the two allegations against Patrick Brown. Make of them what you will. We don't know if they're true. We don't know if they're proven, but they came forward. The media reported on them, and now Brown has resigned. And it was pretty clear that in 5 months' time that he'd probably become premier after the election, because the Liberals in Ontario have been flagging under quite a bit of public backlash against their policies, and a lot of people were looking towards Progressive Conservatives as an alternative. So we're going to have to see how that goes with the PCs in Ontario, and how that's going to affect the election that's going to happen in June.
We're seeing now, new wave of public backlash this week against Patrick Brown.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to have to see if this continues towards the Progressive Conservatives or if it's just on Patrick Brown. Now, just 2 days after Brown's resignation, Vic Fedeli was voted by caucus as interim leader of the Ontario PC Party on Friday. Just hours later, the party executive announced that it would hold an open leadership race to be held on March 24th. Fedeli said he will seek the permanent post. Now, while Brown remains as a member of the provincial parliament for Simcoe North and has denied any wrongdoing, Fedeli called for him to voluntarily take a leave of absence as the allegations are investigated. Now, despite having the power to force Brown out of the caucus if he wants, Fedeli said he was, quote, disgusted by the allegations, but also said that he, quote, never saw anything that would have indicated such behavior by Brown. Now, many media outlets have written editorials or opinion pieces all questioning Brown's character and credibility, such as the Globe and Mail's, quote, "Patrick Brown can protest his innocence, but he had to go." Now, despite the allegations being unproven in a court of law and with due process and the concept of, quote, innocent before until proven guilty, it seems that the court of public has judged these men guilty nonetheless. Now, Christy Blatchford wrote a column for the National Post a week before these stories broke, entitled, quote, "With Me Too, We Have Now Lost the Presumption of Innocence." In it, she says that there has been a shift in society to view allegations as being true without testing them to see whether they are true or not, or waiting for the courts to decide. And that's fostering a culture that paints men as liars and women as truth tellers when it comes to sexual harassment claims. Now, she followed this up with, quote, "What happened to Brown is fundamentally wrong. Every man in the world is now vulnerable." And she writes that, quote, "Kathleen Wynne spent nearly 18 minutes in front of the TV cameras talking about the Brown story. Only one journalist even bothered to ask her about due process. quote, "These are allegations. He's not had a chance to defend himself. Are you in any way concerned that there is a bit of a public trial going on? And is that fair?" the reporter asked. And Wynn didn't comment on the story at all, but then she urged Ontarians to get out their own little flashlights to shine a light into their own lives and to work together to create safe spaces for everyone. Except, of course, everyone doesn't include those being accused, right? Now, the point is that purely on the say-so of two women who claim Brown sexually assaulted them, his reputation and career is permanently ruined, whether true or not. So I'll finish with one last quote from Blatchford. She says, quote, "Whatever the merits of their accusations, and how is anyone to know, the mere act of making them to a journalist was enough. This is all it takes now. It means that every man in the world is vulnerable, not because he has necessarily misconducted himself, but because a woman may say he has. The truth of the alleged misconduct, did it happen? Were there mitigating circumstances? Does the accuser have motive to lie? Is incidental, if not irrelevant."
That story from the National Post hits the nail on the head with this. You know, all of these allegations and whatnot are disgusting, but we have to keep in mind here that there are three lives, three careers now that are ruined. And we are not defending this here at the right side, but just put into your mind, what if one of these allegations turns out to be wrong? What does that mean? What does that mean for Patrick Brown? What does that mean for Jamie Bailey? What could that potentially mean for Kent Hare? And I think Christy Blatchford in the National Post has nailed what we should be talking about at this point, in addition to the allegations, if proven true.
That's right. And who knows, the allegations may be true, but the problem is that we don't know if they're true or not just yet. But it seems like the court of public opinion has painted them guilty regardless. Now, Kent Hare, we've talked about him a lot before and how there's been a lot of investigation into him. So who knows whether that's true or not. It certainly seems like it is, but he still denies the allegations, of course. Now, Jamie Bailey, he seems to have accepted his resignation, and he's going back quietly to a private life. So it seems like we're not going to see anything further about that. Whereas Patrick Brown has vehemently denied the allegations, and he's continuing to deny them. And he says that there was nothing wrong, and that the accused allegations never happened. Now, he was on track to become the next Premier of Ontario, and now he's not going to be anywhere close to being that. So if the allegations are untrue, that's going to be his career ruined, his reputation ruined, and his life ruined, basically. Now, if it was true, then that's a good. That's probably all right. I mean, that's what should happen if something is true like that. But the problem is that it's already happened, and we don't know if it's true yet.
There's
and
no
that's
way of
the
knowing.
Problem.
There's no way of knowing at this point. This needs to go to a court.
There's no way of knowing.
These allegations need to go to a court and be looked at from that angle. Now, there's probably not enough time to do that before the Ontario election this spring. So I can see why they would want him to resign, maybe just based on that. But still, it's something that I think we need to listen when it happens, but at the same time, we need to be wary that, you know, there are potential cases out there, especially in the world of politics, where people want to destroy someone else.
It's true. And I think we need to still encourage people to come forward about this and to listen to them when they do so. But we also need to verify that the stories are true.
Definitely.
And that they actually happened.
Yeah.
And I think that's not for the media to decide when they report these, is that they end up being the judge, jury, and the executioner on a lot of these stories, just because a lot of the public opinion is swayed by what they read or listen to or watch in the media.
Absolutely. And I mean, can you honestly say that Justin Trudeau wants to lose Kent Hare? He's already lost one of his MPs from Calgary. He doesn't want to lose a cabinet minister from Calgary as well.
Yeah, I mean, the Liberals haven't elected anyone in Calgary before this last election since 1968, and now he's potentially losing both of them in Calgary.
Before the next election.
Yeah, before the next election even, and who knows what's going to happen there.
Yeah.
And all because of allegations. Now, I'm not defending them at any, by any stretch of the means. I just think it's interesting how just the mere making of an allegation means that these the accused are basically ruined regardless.
Yeah,
of what
definitely.
Happens.
I'm definitely in the same boat as you on that. And it's something that, you know, needs to be looked at as a society of where we're going with this. You know, not many of these have been debunked as false in the past, whether it be in Canada or the US, but there is going to be one at some point in the future. And that's going to be a moment where everyone just needs to look at this and realize that these are allegations and they need to be thought of as just that. And I think that's a good time for our word of the week. So what's our word of the week?
So our word of the week this week is, of course, allegation, and something that I talked about a lot in the last topic here. Now, allegation is defined as a claim or assertion that someone has done something illegal or wrong. And now, typically, an allegation is made without proof, such as, quote, he made allegations of corruption against the administration, or allegations that the army was operating a shoot-to-kill policy. So these are basically accusing statements being made that someone has done something illegal or wrong, and we don't know if there's proof of them or not, and we don't know if they're true or not. So that's what an allegation is.
And I think that sums up, you know, everything from this firing line as it is, and kind of goes in to give credence to the Christy Blatchford National Post column that was published a week before this. So, All right. Well, there is episode 53 of The Right Side. If you guys want full show notes for this episode to read what we just talked about, rightsidenews.ca. You can also subscribe on iTunes and YouTube at rightsidenews.ca/iTunes and rightsidenews.ca/YouTube. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at RightsideCA. So with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of The Right Side.
And we'll continue to give you the right side of the news and to cut through all the bias and sensationalism that you'll see in the media. And we will be back next week with another episode. We'll see you next week.